We now join our continuing discussion with Simon from Little Storping and the Swuff, already in progress. Previously, in our attempts to find the best new series Doctor Who, we reviewed the categories of The New Guy and The Celebrity Historical. Matt Smith currently holds a 4-2 lead over David Tennant, with Christopher Eccleston still on a duck. And now, part 3. Listening to the Fusion Patrol podcast.
All right, well, our next category is the classic enemy.
Indeed. So I suppose because one of the things anticipated about the new series was how much it would link back and throw back to the old days. And in particular, of course, would the Doctor's most classic enemies reappear? And so early on in the first of the new series, we got the episode Dalek, in which the Daleks reappeared. In the following season, the Cybermen took their turn in the Rise of the Cybermen and the Age of Steel. In the following season, I guess in a way, the returning enemy was the Master, but we'll save that for the finale. They also brought back the Daleks again in Daleks in Manhattan and Evolution of the Daleks. Then it was the turn of the potato-headed Centaurans in the Centauran Stratagem and the Poison Sky. And finally, Earth's rivals for the planet, the... sorry, Eugene, Silurians.
Yeah.
Hungry Earth and Cold Blood.
I'll always call them Silurians. That's what they are. It just rankles a little bit every time.
Well, this is one of the things you think. Well, that was a mistake. They it was a genuine accident. But they have a time machine. They should be able to go back and change it.
Yes, they should. They should. Actually, I wouldn't have minded that. I wouldn't have minded the mistake nearly so much if they hadn't actually tried to talk their way out of it in the Sea Devils. And when you try to, and they only made it worse. that was the part that really got me. It's like the Doctor admits, yeah, that was a mistake. I'm gonna forgive him for not knowing the geologic eras of the Earth. So if somebody says, yeah, there's Silurians, okay, fine. Then when they try to prove, well, you know, the writer's not as bad as you think he is. Yes, apparently he was. All right, let's look at the Dalek.
Yeah, Dalek. We get the Dalek back, but we only get one in this episode, and this is one that's actually based on an audio play. So the guy who wrote Dalek had previously written an audio play called Jubilee, and this picks up on an element within that, where you have a lone Dalek who's been taken prisoner, who's been cruelly treated, and who the companion feels some compassion for. And I think this really works well, the way they did it on television, because Rose has never seen a Dalek before. And so she sees an alien creature being tormented, and she both feels the natural compassion for that, but she also expects the Doctor to display the kind of compassion that the Doctor normally displays. So she's really taken aback by the fear and hatred that she sees in the Doctor, and of course we, or at least those who are seeing this for the first time, see in the Doctor. And I think that really drives home just how terrifying this race are. So instead of having hundreds of sort of Daleks sitting on the conveniently smooth floor of some battleship, waggling their eye stalks to each other and talking at interminable length in the Dalek voices, they actually just do it all with one of them. And that, I mean, for me, that is the best thing about this episode.
I think that this, probably I've mentioned this somewhere along the line, that my opinion of the Daleks is not consistent with apparently the majority of Doctor Who fans. I don't think the Daleks make a good villain. I think that there are very, very few instances that they've been used effectively, and that their menace is always overplayed. It's like, oh, the Daleks are so terrible, oh, the Daleks are so awful, oh, the Daleks are so extremely easy to defeat. And in this case, they made a Dalek that was actually terrifying. That he could take on the entire entrenched security forces of that bunker by himself and, you know, fly around the stairs and whatnot, showed that one Dalek alone is an actual real problem. And so you can extrapolate that where there are thousands of Daleks, you don't stand a chance, that they truly are awesome war machines. And that is very much the core of why I think Dalek works. I also agree, it is interesting that Rose expects the Doctor to be compassionate, and he isn't towards the Daleks. But at the same time, he seems kind of really over the top. And in the new series, the Doctor has always been way over the top when it comes to the Daleks. I mean, his reaction to them is much different than it was in the old series. In the old series, it's like, ah, the Daleks! And, you know, it's like, oh, it's them again. That's a problem, but it's never like I'm going to try to crawl out of my skin to escape the room in terror, or start frothing at the mouth and spitting when you're going on about the Daleks. And I realize that may be something to do with the Time War, but it's I think it's overplayed. But in this case, I forgive it because the Dalek really is terrifying.
I would agree with much of what you just said. As something I said in a previous podcast is that I too am not the world's biggest fan of Daleks. About a year or so ago, I had the privilege of pulling out the classic Hartnell episode, The Daleks. And even though that story pacing is incredibly long, I found the Daleks to be I thought the Daleks were actually scary, something which was unusual for an episode with the production values of that day.
Right and, place and right time, though.
Yes, exactly. And I never got that sense again in any of the follow-up episodes. I mean, there were some episodes that I thought were pretty good. They were enjoyable. I could watch them several times. But I never got that sense of total terror that as to what the Daleks should be able to command. And it wasn't until this episode that, for the first time, I felt, as a viewer, the sense of fear that this creature could actually generate, that it truly is such a dangerous and threatening entity. And in that respect, I really did enjoy the episode. But on the other hand, I had a problem with Christopher Eccleston. I thought, true... Yes, the Doctor is supposed to be a little bit upset regarding the presence of any Daleks, probably because of the Time War. But I thought that Chris Eccleston's reaction was too much. I mean, at moments he went from absolute terror, where he was screaming, "Get me out of this room!" when he saw the Dalek come to life. I mean, it just flipped him out in a way that I found hard to believe. And then when he realized that the Dalek was weaponless, he just started banging the crap out of it. And it just seemed not real. I had a hard time imagining the Doctor behaving in this manner. I could not accept that.
Go ahead.
That was what gave it the dramatic effect for me. It was the fact that he was acting out of character. It was a very non-Doctor-like reaction, and you thought, wow, this really must terrify him.
That's interesting. You're exactly right. It is out of character, and at the same time, it does give you the dramatic impact. The question is, how would that react to someone who was new to Doctor Who? So, in other words, they've only seen the Doctor through a few episodes, and they've got an expectation, much the same way Rose does, of what the Doctor is and how he acts. But then if you're a long-time viewer, you know that he's got a very long history with the Daleks, and then I think this is where you can say it truly is out of character, because it just simply is not like any other reaction he's ever had to Daleks in the past, and I think that might... It might taint my opinion one way or the other. But then
that's where these returning enemies become a millstone. And the Daleks are the classic returning enemies. I think they were probably the first to return. And in my opinion, I actually thought the Invasion of Earth episode was much stronger, because it actually put the Daleks in a familiar situation, and that was pretty frightening in itself. And then... Maybe this was unfortunate, but in Genesis of the Daleks, they were again in another classic episode, which meant that for the next 10 years, they kept coming back again and again with diminishing returns. And yeah, you got this sort of slightly flippant reaction from the Doctor as they struggled to find ways to make the Daleks interesting or terrifying. Then you've got the question now of, well... Do you go with that and carry on with that, or do you try and reinvent the Daleks as something that are genuinely terrifying and use the Time War as an excuse for that? I think they made the right call with that, because I do think that made the Daleks terrifying again. I think it's just a pity that they kept bringing them back again and made the same mistakes over by making...
Yes, and they were no longer terrifying. Yeah, in the subsequent episodes, and that does. And so, yeah, the point taken. I go along. One interesting thing about this episode, and I've got this marked down, yet another episode where the Doctor doesn't save the day. This is that thing with Eccleston, is that over and over again, it's not the Doctor that solves the problem in these episodes. And I don't like that, to be fair. It's once in a while, it's fine, and like I said, once in a while, it's fine. Repeatedly, over and over again, I like it. Shall we move on?
Okay, so then the next monster, probably the other frequently recurring monster, is the Cybermen, which returned in Rise of the Cyberman and the Age of Steel, which was a parallel universe story. So that's me switched off already. Which then attempted to do an origin story for the Cybermen. The parallel universe, I don't know why it was in a parallel universe, but presumably it was because it actually contradicted the original origin of the Cybermen story. Unfortunately, it just...
Which one?
Good. Well, I mean, the general story of the Cybermen is this sort of gradual, and I find this very compelling and slightly terrifying, particularly now, let alone what it must have been like in the 60s, of this idea of gradually augmenting yourself and becoming more and more bionic until the point where you've actually stripped out your emotions and you have just become this unfeeling machine, in effect. And by converting in a process that was so rapid, they took that element away. And I thought that, you know, that was... That detracted from the previous Cybermen story.
I hadn't really thought of it that way. If I recall correctly, the Cybermen were Kit Pedler and Jerry Davis created them originally. And they, if I'm not mistaken, they went on to work, or one or both of them went on to work on Doomwatch, which, you know, is a show all about science going wrong. I mean, they come off as horrific Luddites in a way, but they take all of science and they kind of liken it to the atomic bomb. You know, it's like the horrific consequences are far worse than the research and the science is worth. And the Cybermen were one of their earlier attempts to do that, talking about medical, you know, advances. And you're right, the origin is, whether you say they came up on Telos or Mondas, there's that sort of gradual slipping away of humanity that, you know, now doesn't really make any difference when you come up with them in, say, Revenge of the Cybermen or Earthshock or something, because it's gone. But it does give them a bit of a tragic history and a warning that's not there. So... Yeah, the new origin. I didn't give that any thought, but yeah, it does kind of take away from that.
It's actually based, I mean, it's another one, oddly, in the Returning Enemies. It's actually based on an audio play, or an idea at least from an audio play, which did do the origins of the Cybermen story in the same universe, as it were, going back to Mondas and seeing that. And there's a scene in it, this scene with the converted bride that's taken straight out of it. But they did it much better on audio. So this episode actually compares poorly with previous Cybermen episodes on the television, but also the episode on which it's based, or at least been inspired.
Was that a Peter Davison?
It was a Peter Davison, yeah.
That's odd. I've heard it and I don't remember it. I mean, I've heard that episode and I remember it being on Mondas and... But wow, I
Spare Parts by Mark Platt.
Yeah, that's weird. I didn't put those two together. And let's see, what do we have here? Yeah, now this episode, I thought Tennant was on top of his form, though. Despite the perhaps changes, and I like alternate universe stories. I mean, I love any show that deals with parallel universes where you have the alternate timeline leads to a different world, different technology, different thing. That's just a genre that I've always liked. Unfortunately, it's frequently done in dreadful programs like Sliders or that just ruin it. But typically in books, it's a very good mechanism to get around the time travel story, implications of time travel, and say, what if, Britain's empire collapsed 100 years earlier, or whatever it happens to be. So that doesn't put me off immediately, but it does. It does kind of make it a bit of a cheat because we've got new Cybermen, and then they keep using them in our universe as these new Cybermen. I want to see proper original Cybermen.
Well, I think it's more of a problem having the parallel universe thing in Doctor Who because you have got the timelines that change, or sometimes at least you've got the timelines that change. So you've got to have a really good reason for it being a different parallel universe. And I must admit, I did enjoy it in Inferno, where in the parallel universe you had the drilling had already happened and you had the consequences of that occurring, and you actually saw the same characters in the parallel universe. So they used the parallel universe very cleverly. I couldn't see why they needed a parallel universe for this episode.
I think it was to set up the end, so that they would have a place to put Rose and get rid of her.
Ah.
Perhaps when they start, when they sit around at the beginning of the year, when Russ would get his writers together, if that's how they do it, and say, we have to introduce a parallel universe at some point for the finale. And much like in the Christopher Eccleston, you introduce the monster early and then you bring him back for the finale because it costs a lot to make those costumes. Which is one of the advantages to the longer shows. You get seven parts with the Silurian costumes instead of two episodes. Or anyway, I suspect that may have been part of the mandate when they came on with that story. It's like, all right, I want you to do Cybermen. Just one condition. They got to be in a parallel universe. Ben, how did you like this episode?
Well, I don't necessarily have a problem with parallel universe episodes. This one I didn't care for all too much, and I agree with Simon that it was about the Cybermen. I didn't care for their origins. I felt exactly the same way. I did not like how... Okay, so I suppose you could do a reboot of them since this is an alternate universe, but I really did love the idea of these beings that were slowly augmenting themselves with cybernetic parts. It did make for more compelling drama, and as well as explain why they continued to look different as the series progressed. And to all of a sudden now have this fully realized new race in this what appears to be is going to be their final form, it took a lot of that that the unsettlement, the disturbing factor out of it for me. I mean, at that point, they were just Daleks on legs.
Do we think that the Cybermen still exist in their proper form in our universe, and we just haven't seen them lately?
Yes.
Yes.
I hope so. And that there's gold out there. But, even in the big or sorry, the Pandorica opens, that looked to me like a Cybex Cyberman there. Shall we move on to our next?
Well, in fact, we have proof they exist in our universe because there's a Cyberman head in Van Staten's museum.
That's right. That's right.
2012. I think that was set.
Getting close.
Anyway, yes, indeed. So the next story is the Daleks in Manhattan and evolution of the Daleks. So featuring a 1930s New York setting. Yeah, that may be bad, but it was worse than the story.
Yes, yes, it was. That's worse than my Mockney.
I don't really know where to start with this. I don't have a lot that I could say that's very positive here. So let me actually say nothing.
My notes say, have one line for that episode. It's this train wreck. It's a terrible episode. It's not. I don't think it's going to be winning unless Ben really likes it, but...
Not really, no.
It's not going to be winning, is it?
It did not make any... The story didn't make any sense, that the Daleks would try to turn themselves in more human and then turn around and turn on the guy who is more human because Daleks are programmed to turn against anything that isn't Daleks. It's some of the poorest reasoned logic they've ever used in a story.
What bothered me about it is when we were first introduced to the cult of Skaro, I thought... they really didn't have to export that far, but I thought, well, there's something there. I mean, this could be not a new breed of Dalek, but certainly an advanced form of Dalek that thought a little bit outside the box. And I thought, well, if done right, this could be a real return to how threatening they can be without them wanting to blow up the entire universe. And instead, we were given this.
Well, isn't the Cult of Skaro sort of a cheap way to acknowledge what they learned in Destiny of the Daleks? That if they come up against a robotic race, there's nothing they can do. The two will just be completely impotent against each other, and so that they had to go back and get Davros because he doesn't make any sense. And which was a terrible plot device and horribly realized in that story. But you know, we're back to... The Daleks are robots, and we saw in Dalek that's not true. The Daleks are still living beings. Sometimes we don't get that, but they're not emotionless living beings. They're driven by hate, if nothing else, and hate should make them make wrong decision, non-computer decisions from time to time. So the Cult of Skaro is kind of an interesting idea, but I don't know that it's really necessary, and certainly they didn't demonstrate themselves to being their top strategists in this episode.
Maybe we should move on. From that one.
All right.
The Sontaran Stratagem and the Poison Sky is the next one. The return of the potato-headed Sontarans.
And UNIT.
And UNIT, yes, indeed. And almost, at least in name, General, or is he still Brigadier Alistair Lethbridge Stewart?
I think he called him Sir Alistair, didn't he?
Ah, well, that's a good way of getting around it, isn't it?
Yeah.
I did think that as returning monsters go, they're now running out of the ones that had come back a number of times, and they're now down to the ones that were in more than one episode. So they had two or three sequels, I think, these Sontarans.
Mm-hmm. And not their best ones either.
No, I'm not quite so sure why they're such a popular villain. And this is the problem I have with monster sequels, because originally the monster is created to serve the story. And that's fine, you know, you'll get an inventive monster that serves a purpose within the context of what's being told. But then the monster will be popular, there'll be pressure to bring it back, and the story will have to serve the monster. And then what do you do with your monster? And why is your monster invading Earth? I can't can't honestly even remember in this case.
I think they were making a brood planet for their clone egg sacs, if I remember.
Yeah, they can now clone people, which is a bit like Dalek dupe. No, they don't.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, the Sontarans are all clones, so I would assume that of all races out there, they have clone technology. It probably works pretty well. But
it's still more of a replication process. They didn't create a baby Martha and wait for her to wait.
That's
20
true.
Years for. So this is, I guess you're probably getting the impression that this is an episode of which I'm not particularly fond. I do think that it does have a redeeming feature in the very casual way in which the Doctor sacrifices himself at the end, because I love that. He has to go up to the Sontaran ship, and so he teleports himself with the MacGuffin that is going to blow them up. And both Donna and Martha ask him, well, why don't you just send it up there and automatically blow them up? And he says, because I've got to give them a chance. And it's such a Doctor moment.
That's true.
He does it so casually. And I love that about the episode. It's about the only thing I do like, but I just thought that was done perfectly.
Well, on a couple thoughts there. One, you know, it's a UNIT story, and UNIT is a beloved part of the Doctor Who history, or at least my opinion is that it's a beloved part of the Doctor Who history. And yet, clearly, RTD hates UNIT. Every time he brings in UNIT, they are... I mean, even they just had them in little bits, like in the Christmas Invasion, and... not in the Christmas Invasion. Yeah, in the Christmas Invasion. And I think one other time that they popped up, maybe one guy from UNIT popped up. They're incredibly officious, militaristic, kill 'em dead. And while there was some of that during the UNIT era, they weren't that robots like these guys seem to be. I mean, the Brigadier was smart enough to listen to the Doctor, not always, but and new UNIT is kind of an indictment against any kind of military at all. It
lacks a Brigadier character. It lacks someone who's sympathetic and intelligent and listens to the Doctor. It's like UNIT would have been if the Brigadier weren't there.
I suppose that we could assume that. But it does seem to be like we hate UNIT. So why bring them back? Just bring them back to make them the butt of the jokes in the story. It just didn't... That doesn't work for me. I don't necessarily think that you couldn't have UNIT story without the Brigadier... I think that, you know, there may be some institutional understanding that has come about from what they've learned with their time with the Doctor, but clearly that's not the case. And of course, apart from that, we should mention that Martha is back, now working for UNIT, so this is kind of like a two-companion story with Martha and Donna.
Yeah, that's true. It's the one where she's reintroduced, isn't it?
And the story, as you were saying, the MacGuffin they're trying to do was so incredibly overcomplicated in this plot story. It just didn't make any. You know, we get a company that's going to be making these pollution control devices to collect it all up so that we can then put it all out at once and poison the planet and turn it into a. It was a very convoluted and pointless to make it into a two-part story. But I don't dislike the Sontarans, and I thought they were better in this than they were in their last two appearances, which would be the Two Doctors and Invasion of Time, which were pretty bad. And prior to that, we just had one Sontaran in the Sontaran Experiment and the Time Warrior. And I think that's where the Sontarans work best, is they've just got one of these sort of hyper-warriors in a situation, but not what we get here. We have thousands and shouting and not. Did you love this episode, Ben?
I have. There are some elements to it that I liked, some elements that I did not like. As far as UNIT is concerned, I didn't care for it. It was just another military organization by name. I would take some exception to the idea of you need a Brigadier character. Because the UNIT in the classic Doctor Who was more than just the Brigadier. It was this staff of people that we all got to know. They were all regulars from you had Sergeant Benton,
Yates.
Yeah, that's right. Mike Yates was there. So they were more sympathetic towards the Doctor than the Brigadier was. If you really start looking at those classic episodes, the Brigadier, he had some level of respect for him, but at the end of the day, he was still a military man. And in his mind, it was blow him up first. And you had Mike Yates and Benton, who would sort of try and temper the Brigadier's approach to things, not so much the Doctor. So I found it made UNIT a far more interesting organization because you had these different personality types that we all got to know over a period of time. Something which you can't do in this one particular in this new episode. There wasn't time to do that. It just became another military organization, which at that point I totally lost interest. As far as Martha goes, it was great to see her again. The interplay between Martha and Donna I thought was a great deal of fun. I did like the Sontarans. I thought for the first time, and I agree, since the Sontaran experiment, I thought the Sontarans were portrayed really, really well. They're supposed to come from a very dense gravity planet, if I remember right. So seeing their compact structure, I thought really came off quite well. I could not stand the boy.
Oh, yeah, he was terrible.
He drove me out of my mind.
Young Bill Gates.
Yeah, he really was. Couldn't wait to see him go away. I did find some humor in these little machines that were placed in everybody's cars. And the only reason I laugh at it is because on a recent vacation, my partner and I were driving back east, and we had GPS, and it was giving us the most bogus directions on how to get where we wanted to go. And so to see this kind of scenario play out, it made me laugh, but that was a personal thing. Other than that, like I said, it has elements that I like, elements I don't like. So I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. Maybe I was a tiny bit let down.
Who hasn't?
Who it was more than I hoped for?
Ben, who hasn't been led astray by a GPS and driven off a bridge that's out before? I mean, that is a common experience, I understand. You read about it in the paper all the time.
I should tell you one day about our experience driving in Southern California with a GPS.
I have my own.
That was what they were going for, and it happens quite often in Russell T. Davies' thing. He picks something that he's going to satirize, but the way he does it becomes so heavy-handed that, and in this case, it's everyone's got the device from the same manufacturer, and it's impossible to remove it or deactivate it, and it goes way beyond the original joke to the point where you're just thinking, well, yeah.
That's kind of silly, yeah. I take a brief thought here. It just occurred to me, I'm busting on the way they portrayed UNIT. There is one good thing about the way they portrayed UNIT. I don't know if you remember in one of the specials where the Brigadier came back, I'm not sure which one, they came up against a monster and he says something to the effect of, you know, oh, just once I'd like to meet a monster that isn't bulletproof. Or, you know, in other words, by the time the Brigadier reaches the end of his line, he recognizes that military might doesn't always work. And that, you know, sometimes that isn't the approach. So the Brigadier grows as a character over time.
Definitely.
But one thing about this UNIT story is their technology works. They're not stupid. The Doctor actually makes fun of them. He says, well, you're not going to fight these guys off with bullets. And the Brigadier surrogate pulls out these bullets and said, you know, these bullets have been designed this way, that they will penetrate Sontaran armament. And he's right. So UNIT isn't stupid. They've been progressing, too. They've been learning from their mistakes over the years. And they even have that master-built aircraft carrier to come in and blow away the smoke. So their techniques are good. They're efficient militarily in this story, and yet they're portrayed unsympathetically across the board, and I didn't like that part. I like UNIT.
So in fairness, it was the master who built the aircraft.
It was. It was. But UNIT used it in a useful way. And they, you know, brought it in and said, okay, we've got that covered. So somebody's tactically planning well on that. All right, and so on to...
Yeah, finally in this character we have the return of the Silurians in the Hungria cold blood. And I thought this was quite an interesting two-parter. And in terms of part one, the Hungry Earth, it is definitely intentionally a Pertwee homage, because the number of things where you think this is, you know, this has happened before, and you've got the equivalent of the heat barrier in, was it the demons with the heat barrier?
Yeah, heat barrier in the demons.
And obviously you have the Silurians themselves.
You've got drilling.
Drilling like Inferno, yes. So there are all sorts of little nods that you get in there.
Whales. No, whales like as in Green Death, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. So in terms of that, there were little nods that I didn't think overwhelmed the story, but were quite nice to just sit there and spot. And I like the way in which the relationship between Amy and the Doctor was developing there, although part of that I think I saw in a scene that was cut out.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of hope that they produce a slightly longer version of that first episode. And if they need to make space for it, I reckon they could probably leave out the second episode altogether.
It was a bit of a letdown on the second part, wasn't it?
I didn't think they could actually go down.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't dislike the first episode. I mean, I didn't exactly love it, but it was beautifully done. It was an homage to the Pertwee era. It definitely had its moments. I didn't think much of the Silurian costumes. I really, they're too human for a variety of reasons. But we thrashed that over on the podcast. It's kind of a letdown episode for the return of my favorite monster for no good reason, but they just happen to be my favorite monster. So. I'll leave it at that on Hungry Earth and Cold Blood. Ben?
What else I could say that I haven't said already? I really was sorely disappointed with this episode. I couldn't stand the Silurians one bit. I loved how they were portrayed in the Pertwee series and then revisited in the Peter Davison shows. So to see what we got, it just really... No, I just couldn't buy it. There was nothing about it, and there was a little bit of timey-wiminess going on there that felt like a little bit of a waste of effort. And that was at the beginning of the episode. We see older Amy and older Rory across on another hill, and that was never fully exploited.
That never did make sense.
Yeah, at least not to my satisfaction. They didn't deliver with that. I thought that there was something more that could have been done with that. And aside from the end of the episode where we just see Amy alone, there really wasn't much to it. It became almost irrelevant.
Wasn't that the point, to see Rory wiped out in the future?
But did we need to see it that way? I mean,
no,
did
not for me.
I got that from just the fact that Amy forgot him and that he was gone. I mean, I took that from the episode. It's like I didn't need to see them in the future at all. I don't think it added anything to my understanding of what happened to Rory. It wasn't that confusing. I mean, I was like, he's dead and he's gone.
But I think it was part of Stephen Moffat trying to make it clear that the future can change, so that he was in at the beginning. I don't think it did work particularly well, but my understanding of what he was trying to do was at the beginning establish one version of the future, and then post that ending scene, which I'm pretty sure he must have written, take another version of the future, the no Rory version of the future. and contrast it.
You have to wonder why Amy by herself came out there just to stand on a hill and wave at them, though. You know,
it doesn't
make any sense. And it in retrospect, now that the series is over, it looks like something that's setting you up for some point in the future in the story or in the series. But then it isn't. And so it just feels so, you know, if they could have cut those scenes out and they could have put that scene back with the doctor and Amy walking and talking about whether she likes Rory and he likes Rory and whatnot, which I think is the scene you're probably talking about. Their interplay. I think that would have been a good place. They could have saved a few minutes and done that, kept it in. But that's the editor's choice. Okay. Well, let Simon go first and say which one's the winner.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm going to go for Dalek because most of these stories to me just feel like the story serving the monster, whereas Dalek. Actually, I mean, the story did a great service to the Daleks in that it made them frightening again, or this Dalek in particular frightening again. But it was a cracking story, both in terms of revitalizing the Daleks, but also in terms of the development of the relationship between Rose and the Doctor.
Is that the first episode where we actually reveal that the Time War was the Daleks and the Time Lords?
I think so.
I think it is, yes.
Okay. Ben, who's your...
I got to go with Dalek for many of the same reasons. You, for the first time in many, many, many years, we see a lone Dalek that was able to generate real terror, not just for the other characters in the story, but also to create some sense of unease for the viewer, something which has been long absent. And I agree that it took the relationship between the Doctor and Rose, it took it a little further. So in that respect, yes, I would have to say that's the strongest of this category.
Well, you have almost convinced me. But despite everyone else's reservations, I am still going to stick just slightly with Rise of the Cybermen and Age of Steel, because I like parallel universe stories, and I thought that was a very exciting and interesting story, and I like Cybermen better than Daleks, but I agree that Dalek, it's really close, but I'll just be obstinate and go with the other one. Just
Descender.
Oh,
conformist.
I'm a nonconformist. I'm an SP. And so we come to the end of part 3 of our special podcast. Christopher Eccleston is finally off the mark with a double. David Tennant picks up 1 point, bringing him up to 3. And Matt Smith stays the same at 4, just barely holding on to his lead. Join us again next time for part 4.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol podcast. We'd love to hear your feedback. Contact us at feedback@fusionpatrol.com or follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fusionpatrol. Our theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.